Merry Christmas and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. In the midst of the 12 days of Christmas, the season where we have all kinds of joyful kind of traditions for remembering the infant Lord come among us, whom we have welcomed into our homes and our hearts, and has made everybody from shepherds to wise men happy. The only people unhappy about this, the Herods of the world. So time to be joyful, time to have a little fun, and that's what we do all this week. And it's the Feast of St. John the Apostle as well. And today we have apologist Michael Lofton with us from Reason and Theology. That's his podcast. And we're going to do his questions from his patrons. So there are folks who support him and his work. And so today we've got questions from them. Michael Lofton, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me back, Cy. And by the way, Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Do you like my Christmas theme microphone?
I love it. I was just thinking that I need to have one on my mic.
Well, you have, but you got your green on for Christmas.
That's
so
it.
I got the red. You got the green, and I got this little Santa hat because I thought I would wear it for the Christmas season. But it's from the 99-cent store, and it's apparently made for like hobbits or tiny little people because it looks like a tiny little hat on my giant Irish head. So it's on the microphone instead.
Yeah, and I don't know how it would work with the headphones too. Would it?
I could probably arrange it.
I
think I could probably do that. But like, look at this, Michael. Like, look at the size of this thing. Like, it doesn't even without the headphones. I can't. All right, well, there's kind of something
really
going on.
Squeeze it on there. Yeah.
Okay, it's going back on the microphone.
Yeah.
Well, you have your youngest child is how old?
Four.
Okay. So how is Christmas for a four-year-old this year? Like anticipation, excitement before? Or?
Very much anticipation. He's been asking all year. Anytime he wants a toy, he says, can I get this for Christmas?
And you know
what my answer is, right?
What do you say?
We'll see. Maybe. Oh,
that's the prudent answer.
So I imagine he's expecting all of the toys that he's requested all year long to be under the Christmas tree, which is of course not going to happen.
No, of course. But still, when you're four, Christmas is just the biggest day. It's just a huge day. And you live where you really don't get Christmas snow, and I live where you really don't get Christmas snow, but we still have fun at Christmas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's always a great time.
All right. So I got all these questions for you. I got to tell you this one thing, too, because it's the 12 days of Christmas here at Catholic Answers. They're doing, and by they, I mean the people in the marketing department, they're doing kind of a fun little 12 days of Christmas online game. So I'm going to be getting to that after our first break. I'll be letting people know how they can participate in this and maybe get some free merch. That's the fancy word for merchandise. I found that out. Have you noticed this, that all words have to be like four letters now because of texting? Like there's a four-letter word or sometimes just a one-letter version of every word. I cannot decipher it. You might as well just write in Egyptian hieroglyphs.
That's a good point. They do kind of, you know, shorten everything. In fact, I just saw a thumbnail that said trad instead of traditional.
Yeah,
you're right. Yeah. There you go. Four letters.
Well, how do you text like words in your business where you're talking about the hypostatic union and homoousion and homoousius and all that? What are the, what's the texting version?
You know, a fun one for me, instead of typing out Constantinople, I just type COPLE. Copal, because I don't want to sit there and type the whole thing on my phone.
So. You're part of the problem.
Yeah, I do kind of have.
You're part of the problem.
Versions.
I can't.
I
even,
am.
I thought you were going to defend language, and you're defacing it. I'm not going to give out the number today because all the questions that we have are from Michael's patrons at Reason and Theology. And before I get to that, what do you do at Reason and Theology? What is it? It kind of sounds a little self-explanatory, but. Give us the pitch.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I sometimes do interviews with people. I might host debates or just roundtable discussions. But a lot tends to be either teaching moments or reviews of other people's videos. So a little bit of everything and on all kinds of topics, whether it's questions within Catholicism, engaging Protestants, engaging atheists, and also Eastern Orthodoxy.
And how often do you drop a new episode?
I usually do something once a day.
That is a lot of work, isn't it?
It really is, because there's a whole lot that goes on behind the scenes that you have to do, thumbnails, descriptions,
right,
stuff like that. So it does take some time.
Yeah. We do focus once a week here, and I always think it's done. You know, and then Edgar will be like, "Did you write a description for it? Did you write a title for it?"
Timestamps.
Just put it out there. Yeah. Mail it. Whatever. What do we do with it? I don't know where it goes. Just send it. Like, put it somewhere. But yeah, there's always all these little details. That's why we're glad we have Edgar.
That's right.
All right. I'm going to get you to some questions. Maybe at some point I'll ask you a little bit about St. John the Apostle, because it is the feast day of St. John the Apostle today, just 2 days after the big nativity feast. So we'll ask about St. John. You are, I assume, pro St. John. You're in favor of St. John the Apostle?
I didn't know that anyone was opposed to St. John. Help me out here.
The Gnostics are. They don't like him.
Well, definitely First John, right? I mean, he's engaging them there. And also the Gospel of John, it's clearly a treatise against the Gnostics. But yeah, I was thinking in terms of pro or against within Catholic circles.
No.
Yeah, we're going way back here talking about the Gnostics now.
Yeah. All right. I just wanted to make sure which team you're on before we go forward.
I'm definitely on St. John's team.
Okay, there we go. That's all you needed to say, Michael. That's all you needed to say was, I like St. John the Apostle. All right, I'm going to... give you one of your questions from one of your patrons. I've read through some of these questions that came from your patrons. Mm-hmm. You have very smart people listening to your podcast. This is no joke.
They're awesome.
All right.
Yeah.
First one, how does Catholicism interpret the Tome of Leo when it says, "For each form does what is proper to it with the cooperation of the other"? That is the Word performing what appertains to the Word, and the flesh carrying out what appertains to the flesh. Mm-hmm. One of them sparkles with miracles, the other succumbs to injuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot going on here. For those who might not be familiar with the Tome of Leo, this was something that Pope St. Leo the Great put out. He lives in the 5th century. He puts this out just a little bit before the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And he sends this out to settle a controversy on, does Jesus have two natures, one nature, one person, two persons? That whole era where we were fighting over those issues, he settles that in his tome, and he sends this out, and eventually it was also received at the Council of Chalcedon. But effectively, what he's communicating here is that he's noting that there are two natures. We might say that there are two natures united in one person, what's called a hypostasis. But he's making a very important distinction here. It's not like after the incarnation, when the second person of the Holy Trinity takes on human nature. It's not like somehow the divinity, the divine part, is somehow confused with the humanity, so it's not really divine anymore, or he's not fully human anymore after the incarnation, it's something else. No, he's saying there's still this divine nature, and there's still this human nature fully intact, and each nature does what is proper to it. So you might say that when Scripture talks about Jesus growing in wisdom and stature, it's referring to the human nature, not to his divinity, clearly. That's not appropriate to the divine nature. That's only something that the human nature would do. So the human nature grows, gets hungry, gets tired, whereas the divine nature knows all things, right? Yeah. So in other attributes of the divinity, whereas we would say that's not appropriate to say of the humanity, very technically speaking, although there is what's called the communicatio idiomatum, where we can speak of the divine nature suffering, and then we can speak of vice versa. But as long as we're, again, keeping these distinctions in mind, that those things that pertain to the divinity are proper to the divinity, those things that pertain to humanity are proper to it. And we have to make that distinction. So that's effectively what he's getting at there in the tome.
Is this language, I mean, because this is coming from the middle of the 5th century, if I'm correct. So is this language we would still use today, or has the church kind of found a more... apt language to use to describe these things over the centuries.
It's still the language that we use today, but some people have been confused over this language. In fact, going back to the Council of Chalcedon, there was a great portion of people in the East that were confused over this language of us speaking of two natures. They were very confused about this, thinking that we're maybe even talking about two persons whenever we refer to Jesus. So there was a lot of confusion over the language, which some of that still persists, unfortunately, unto this day. So we do still use that language, but sometimes there is some confusion on it, so we have to explain it. Fortunately, some of those Eastern Christians that were originally confused on this language, we have had been able to have dialogues with them and clear the air and explain that this was effectively just a language barrier. And that we're essentially saying the same thing, but we were just kind of using different terminology.
This Michael Lofton is our guest on this Feast of St. John the Apostle. The third day of Christmas, right? Because Christmas is the first day of Christmas, and then Boxing Day is the second day. And today, St. John the Apostle is the third day of Christmas. So we're just one quarter of the way through the 12 days of Christmas. We will take our first break. And when I come back, as I said, I will give you your clue to how to get that free merch over at shop.catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to catholicquestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at catholicquestions.com today. That's catholicquestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics. Tonight, 8 Eastern on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Merry Christmas. I hope you are having a merry Christmas season. Michael Lofton is our guest, very fine apologist, and the proprietor of the Reason and Theology podcast. Now, I said I was going to give the clue, and I have to read this just the way they put it in my hand, because it's a little poem. And if I read you the little poem, then you have a clue about how to get the free merch, which is short for merchandise, over at shop.catholic.com. Each day of Christmas, we'll be reading a clue leading you to a book title at shop.catholic.com. If you're one of the first five to locate the product and use the attached promo code, you will get it for free. Today is the third day of Christmas, day three, three French hens. Faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. Once again, here's the little poem clue to use over at shop.catholic.com. Faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. Happy hunting at shop.catholic.com. Michael, are you with us, or did you go over to your computer to try to get a free book? Is Michael still here?
I am here. Okay. Can you see me?
Yeah, I can see you. I thought maybe you had you were like all excited about finding the three French hens over at shop.catholic.com. All right, all of our questions today coming from your patrons. I kind of like these when we get to just relax and take questions from patrons type shows for Christmas. It's nice.
It's fun.
I like that kind of calm that comes after Christmas. Maybe you got a few days off and you're not shopping anymore and the dishes are finally done from the Christmas. Well, in my house, 2 days after Christmas. No, it'd probably be a few more days till the dishes are done. But we're starting. We're soaking. The dishes are at least soaking right now. All right. All right. Here's another question for you from one of your patrons. How has Catholicism defined hypostasis and nature throughout history?
Yeah, so this is a really complex one. Let's maybe start with the way it's currently defined. It really has been defined since effectively the time of the Cappadocians in the early church. So we might speak of what's called in Greek ousia, which can be translated as nature, essence, substance. We might even make some distinctions between those, but they're roughly the same thing. Whenever we speak of God as one, that's what we're referring to, right? I mean, we don't believe in multiple gods. We're not polytheists. We believe in one God, monotheism. When we're speaking of that one aspect of God, we're referring to the ousia, substance, nature. Whenever we speak of the multiplicity, if you will, for God, we're referring to persons. So this in Greek is called hypostasis. So that's the term that we use. So we speak of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is not the Father. We make distinctions there when it comes to relations between these persons, while still recognizing one nature. So one ousia, three hypostases. That's what we currently believe, and as I indicated, that's what we've been saying since roughly the time of the Cappadocians in 400s or so. However, prior to that, here's where it gets sticky. The term ousia could mean different things. Hypostases actually meant the same thing as ousia at one point. So whenever we speak of three hypostases, three persons, that could have been confusing to some people because it sounded like we're saying three gods, three natures.
Yeah.
And we're not saying that. We're saying three persons. But again, if you use the term hypostases in the same way as ousia, you're going to conflate those and it's going to sound weird. Another fun fact is at the time of the Council of Nicaea, we decided, again, we're going to use the term ousia to refer to one God. And we speak about how Jesus is consubstantial with the Father, homoousias with the Father, of the same substance with the Father. Well, the problem with that is that term prior to Nicaea was used by heretics to speak of a heretical view of God. And here Nicaea is using the term, but not in the heretical sense, in the orthodox sense. So it was confusing to some because some at Nicaea were saying, well, wait, we're using the term homoousios, but heretics used to use that term. So this is getting confusing here. So we had to go through that whole battle. So in other words, there is a long history where some of these terms were being used differently, but that's now how we use them, especially since the time of the Council of Chalcedon and onward.
Sense something, trying to get language to bear meaning, carry the meaning of something so mysterious. It's hard work to get language to do that.
It is, and this is a problem because it caused so many divisions in the early church. A lot of the divisions that happened in the early church were partly political, sure, but much of it was due to a breakdown in languages because some are speaking in Greek, others are speaking in other languages, perhaps Latin, among others. And whenever we would try to say, okay, well, we believe that God is one ousia, and then try to translate that into Latin or something else, there might be some confusion and a breakdown in language, and people are thinking we're saying things that we're not. And so that caused a lot of schisms and division and breakdown in church unity because people were thinking that, you know, one group was denying that God is one, or one was denying distinctions in the Trinity. And in fact, that really wasn't the case. But at the time, we just did not know that because of the language barrier.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And that's why, like I'm saying, you got these very smart listeners over at Reason and Theology who ask a question like that, or like this. Here's the next question from one of Michael's patrons at Reason and Theology. Would the Orthodox have to accept transubstantiation if the Catholic and Orthodox were to be reunited?
Mm-hmm. So for those who might not be familiar, transubstantiation is a dogma in the Catholic Church defined really before the Council of Trent. Most people associate it with Trent, but it was actually 1215 where it was defined. And this is the claim that Jesus is really and truly substantially present in the Eucharist under the appearances of bread and wine. So we say the substance is changed, but the accidents remain the same. The way it appears to us remains the same, but what it is it's truly the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. So the question here is, do the Orthodox have to accept that? Well, the Orthodox believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. So we can say that they already believe the essence of what we're saying, but they might not use that same terminology of substance and accidents, but effectively what they're communicating is the same thing. Now, would they have to accept the language of transubstantiation? That's what we would say, no, not necessarily, as long as they mean the same thing. In other words, as long as you mean the same thing, you might be able to use different language, but it needs to be the same concept. So this is something that we, again, often see throughout history. We might have different ways of describing things as far as just the language that we use, but as long as we mean the same thing when it boils down to it, we can still share communion. And so it is with the Orthodox. As long as they accept what we mean by transubstantiation, sure. And they have to do that for us to have church unity, because this if they don't, that would then mean that we do have essentially a different faith, or that there are some things that are dogmatic for us but not for them. And that's not going to work when it comes to doctrinal unity. If it's dogmatic, it's dogmatic for everyone. If it's true,
right.
It's true for everybody. And effectively, this is already the case, because for those Orthodox who have come into communion with Rome, known as Eastern Catholics, we have to believe the same things that Latin Rite Catholics believe whenever the church teaches authoritatively. And the church has defined the matter of transubstantiation. So Eastern Catholics have to accept it, transubstantiation. Even if we're not using the same language, we have to accept the meaning of transubstantiation.
You know, I'm such an infant when it comes to understanding the any nuance at all in the Orthodox Catholic theological interactions. But it does seem to me that I know many really good Catholic kind of sacramental theologians, people who can, you know, really explain the theology of the Eucharist, for example, who find extraordinary value in the theology of the East. I'm thinking particularly of Father Schmemann, who wrote on the Eucharist. I think there's it doesn't seem to me that this is one of those things where Catholics are like, nah, all right. It just seems like the Catholics are very much enriched by Eastern thinking on the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And it also goes both ways. I think there's a whole lot of contributions that the West can offer for the East, but you're right. So we've often focused on the West to the exclusion of the East, and we're now starting to appreciate those things. But, you know, I think if you were to ask an Orthodox, do you believe this is Christ? This is truly Christ.
Right.
They're going to say, yeah. And if you ask them, what does it look like? Well, it looks like bread and wine. Okay, guess what? You just affirmed transubstantiation by saying that, whether you use that term or not. So I think that we're already in agreement with the Orthodox on this one.
All right. Thank you. We got time for another question before we have to go to a break. Michael Lofton is our guest. And all the questions come from patrons to his podcast, Reason and Theology, which you should check out. Lots of great conversation there. And interviews and all kinds of cool stuff, and a great bookshelf. It's a really good. Oh, there it is right behind you now. The legendary bookshelf. So here's another question for you, Michael. I often hear Orthodox claims about how the first millennium ecclesiology was Orthodox and not Catholic. Is this true?
So for those who might not be familiar with the term ecclesiology, this just means it's a fancy term that refers to how the church is set up, the structure of the church. So the question is, did the first millennium teach Eastern Orthodox ecclesiology or Catholic ecclesiology? Well, unfortunately, there is no one view among the Eastern Orthodox on ecclesiology. So I think that the question already assumes something that I reject. I think it's more appropriate to speak of Eastern Orthodox ecclesiologies. There are some, for instance, that would hold to a very high view of the papacy. And there are some Eastern Orthodox who would hold a very low view of the papacy. There are some Eastern Orthodox who would hold to a very high view of the Patriarch of Constantinople and his role in the church, and others who would hold to a very low view of the Patriarch of Constantinople and his role. So there's a wide variety here in Eastern Orthodoxy. That being said, we could still ask the question, does the first millennium teach Eastern Orthodox ecclesiologies or Roman Catholic ecclesiology?
Could we?
I guess we'll pick it up on the other
one. Yeah, I guess so. Very good. Michael Lofton, our guest, as we continue celebrating the Christmas season here at Catholic Answers. We'll be right back with more patron questions for Michael Lofton right after this on Catholic Answers Live. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and Merry Christmas. I am Cy Kellett, your host. The Christmas season continues on towards the Feast of the Epiphany on the 6th. So the 12th day of Christmas is the 5th day of January, and we got the 12 days of Christmas. Today is the Feast of St. John the Apostle, and I kind of like these week after Christmas programs because we get to kind of take a little slower pace and have fun and get to talk to the apologists a little bit about just chatting type stuff. But then Michael Lofton, who's the proprietor of the Reason and Theology podcast, he asks his patrons to give us some questions, and these they're like PhD level questions. You were in the midst of your answer about what people would have thought about the church in the first millennium, how they would have described the church, all that, how they would have thought about it. Is that Orthodox? Like, does that look more like the Orthodox of today or like the Catholic Church of today? And you were in the midst of the answer and we had to take that break, Michael.
Yeah, and it's such a complex question. We could be here for hours answering this one, but I'll try to just summarize it as follows. I do think that you can find some of the distinctives that you find in Eastern Orthodox ecclesiology. I do think you can find those in the first millennium. And I also think that you can find Catholic ecclesiology, for instance, on the papacy in the first millennium. I think that there are rival views in the first millennium in the early church. They're competing with one another in the same way that you have rival views on who Jesus is. Somebody might say he's God. Somebody might say he's man. Somebody might say he's both. Somebody might say he's neither. Somebody, you know, there's all kinds of views that were being debated in the early church on all sorts of areas. And likewise, so it is with how the church is structured, ecclesiology. So I do think that you can find Eastern Orthodox views on the church in the first millennium, but you can also find the Catholic view. Now, since you can find multiple views, what do we do here? Well, in the same way that we settled, you know, what is the truth about who Jesus is? If we have multiple views in the early church on who Jesus is, how do we settle that? Ultimately, it's the magisterium, the teaching authority of the church. And unfortunately, that's where some of the disagreement is with the Eastern Orthodoxy. What is the magisterium? So now we have to look at, well, how did the ecumenical councils themselves work? Because we, as Catholics, share the first seven ecumenical councils with the Eastern Orthodox. So we can ask the question, well, the first seven councils that we're in agreement with, how did they work in their teaching authority? And what's curious is in several of these ecumenical councils, they're teaching the papal doctrines of papal infallibility, papal indefectibility in its teaching office. You're seeing that in the ecumenical councils themselves. So when we point to the area that we already agree on, we as Catholics want to say, well, you know what? Our understanding of ecclesiology, especially when it comes to the papacy, is right there in the councils that we agree on. And that's where the debate takes place between us with the Orthodox. Do the councils in fact teach some of these teachings about the Pope, this papal primacy and papal indefectibility that we see later on defined at Vatican I? Do these councils in fact do that? Well, we're going to argue yes, and I think there's a very strong case for it. We can see that with Philip the Legate at the Third Ecumenical Council, Pope Agatho at the Sixth Ecumenical Council, Hadrian at the Seventh. So, I mean, there's other instances. We could talk about the Council of Chalcedon and Leo's role there. So I hope that helps answer the question. But then again, I know there's a lot more that could be said here. What do you think, Si? Does that get to the essence of it?
It seemed to me, and it comes down to like like if you go to an Orthodox website and they have a graphic of the history of the church. And you go to a Catholic website of a graph, they both look like a tree with branches coming off of them. But in Orthodoxy, the main branch that continues straight through history with Latin Rite branching off at one point, and the Catholic will have the main branch through history is going straight through history is the Catholic Church and Orthodoxy branching off. So the question is, where's the main branch? And that's, I think, what this question is about. Well, isn't if the ecclesiology of the first millennium looks like Orthodoxy, then it's the Catholic Church that you should be, that graphic, that tree of Christianity that everybody's got on Catholic and Orthodox websites looks like the main trunk of the tree is Orthodoxy. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what I think the root of the question.
I do. And what I would say as far as this, we're asking what really makes the church, to have that continuity, that line continuously throughout history. Right. What makes the church the church? We're in agreement with the Orthodox that on the local level, the bishop is essential to the structure of the church, those who are gathered around the bishop. But we have a problem. We have bishops as Catholics, and Eastern Orthodox have bishops, and we're not fully in communion with each other. So what do we do now? Well, we want to say above the local level, there's this universal level. What keeps that intact? The churches throughout all of the world, all these various bishops, what holds them together? We say the papacy, and that's expressed in the first millennium, not only in some of the ecumenical councils, but the bishops in the East even signed off on the claim that it's the Pope who holds them together in what's called the formula of Hermisdis, which was roughly in the 500s, and it settled the schism that was taking place in the East. Again, over 250 Eastern bishops signed off on Pope Hermisdis' formula that taught the papacy and taught this idea that the Pope is what holds everything together, because he identifies communion with the Catholic Church as communion with the Bishop of Rome. He identifies that very clearly in the formula, and you have the East signing off on this. So we as Catholics want to say, that's what holds the churches together. It's right there in the first millennium, And we're just calling Orthodox to accept what they already signed off on in the first millennium.
Yeah. You know what? As you were saying that, I was thinking what you don't see is like Seventh-day Adventists with everybody breaking off. You know, it's only the Orthodox and the Catholics who have this little tree graphic, you know, and nobody else, because it's obvious that, well, at least it seems obvious. that Seventh-day Adventists are not the main trunk of the tree going all through history. All right, so on to another question from a patron of the Reason and Theology podcast, which our guest, Michael Lofton, created and is the proprietor of today. This question, not an Orthodox Catholic question, but a Protestant Catholic question. Protestants often balk at Catholic apologists claiming all of the fathers, in quotes, on an issue. The same Protestants will justify their rejection of the fathers as an authority by stating that they are so varied in opinion on things that no one can really claim them. How do we respond to them in a nuanced way that doesn't exaggerate the patristic agreement on a subject, but demonstrates the importance of listening to their witness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the church fathers are not always in agreement with each other on every single doctrine, and that's not even what we're claiming. We don't claim that the church fathers have to be in agreement on every single thing that the Catholic Church teaches. That's not our position. What we are saying is that when there is a unanimity among the church fathers on a matter of faith and morals, that would not be something that we could transgress. But we're not saying that they always have that unanimity. And even here, we have to qualify that further. When we speak of unanimity, are we talking about literally every single church father to the man? No, but a moral majority, right? Yeah. A moral unanimity, but not necessarily literally every single church father has to agree on this particular thing, because that would reduce things to very few points. I mean, there's very few areas where you have that kind of unanimity, but there are plenty of areas where you have a moral unanimity on a matter of faith and morals among them.
Could interrupt you there? Because I think we have a modern precedent for that in the church. Like if you say, what is marriage? There's a unanimity among the bishops, but you're definitely going to get some bishops who don't agree. But in a moral sense, it's clear what the church believes, what the bishops, and this is not the fathers, of course, but this is just contemporary bishops. And not to call out any particular bishops, but, you know, some German and Flemish bishops. Oh, wait, I did just call them out. But still, if you look at the church today, say, how does the church define marriage? Even though there's not a perfect unanimity, there is a moral unanimity there.
That is a perfect analogy, because that often comes. Yeah, you got it.
Nice.
That often comes up. We will speak about whenever there is a constant teaching of the bishops dispersed throughout the world in union with the Pope. We call that the Ordinarian Universal Magisterium. We might speak of those things as authoritative, and somebody might come along and say, but there's this bishop way out there who rejects this particular thing, and he believes that you can ordain women or something like that. And it's like, okay, well, one or two bishops is not destroying the kind of unanimity that we're referring to. We're referring to a unanimity insofar as kind of a moral majority among the bishops, not necessarily to the man, to every single bishop. So that's a perfect analogy, yeah. So I think that sometimes we as Catholics do kind of overstate our case when it comes to Protestants and the church fathers, because we recognize that in a lot of cases, the Protestants are just neglecting the fathers. We sometimes overstate our case and our zeal to defend the fathers. And we do speak of unanimity among the fathers as if it's this thing that the church fathers are always in agreement on everything. And I think we might need to mitigate that just a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. What we're trying to know ultimately is the mind of the church, right? We're trying to say, how has the church been thinking about this? And so we're...
Yeah.
And that's a historical question. You have to look at history to know that.
And what I found helpful, because I started asking these same questions, I found Father Emmanuel Duranzo's work called Channels of Revelation. In fact, it's online for free in a PDF. I found that to be incredibly helpful, because he starts to dive into questions like the consensus of the fathers and how to identify it. So certainly check that out.
All right, it's time to take another break. We're doing patron questions from Michael's podcast. Michael is an associate. An affiliate apologist here at Catholic Answers. I don't know why I keep saying associate apologist when you're on, Michael, because I feel we're associated with one another.
Yeah, but that works too.
But we're even more than associated. We're affiliated with one another.
There we go.
And he has got a very fine podcast, Reason and Theology, and all the questions come from the patrons of that podcast. We'll continue with that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ. He once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're in the midst of the 12 days of Christmas, so Merry Christmas to you. And while we're in the midst of the Christmas season, why not have some poems and some fun and some games and some free stuff? And that's what they're doing over at shop.catholic.com. Today's the third day of Christmas. And here's the little poem that you you go to shop.catholic.com, and this little poem is a clue for you to hunt for the free books. Faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. You'll know what that means, I guess, when you get over to shop.catholic.com. Faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. Again, Michael Lofton is our guest, and we're taking questions from his patrons. And now we got one that... this bugs people. This is a tough one. So it's a little bit long, the question, but I'll read you the whole question, and then I'll be fascinated, actually, to hear what you have to say. The teaching of the Magisterium on young earth creationism and evolution are difficult for me to reconcile. I am personally very convinced of an old earth, but my conversion to Catholicism was helped in large degree by the witness of the fathers. From what I understand, besides Augustine, who still believed in an earth that is thousands and not billions of years old, there is a consensus of the fathers on this issue that the Bible teaches that the earth is young, not old. What exactly goes into the Magisterium's ruling that this is a matter outside the scope of the fathers? And can that standard be applied consistently to other doctrines to show that we are reasonable and consistent to reject this patristic consensus without asking Protestants and Orthodox to be bound on other areas where there is patristic consensus? Ooh, that's a good question. That is question.
Yes, there's at least three things going on in there that I want to try to tackle. Very good question. So number one, I challenge that the Magisterium is authoritatively taught young earth or old earth. I challenge that it's taught either. So I think it still remains to be seen whether or not there has been a magisterial intervention on this question. I'm of the opinion that there hasn't been. I'm willing to be corrected there. But I have not seen the church definitively or even just authoritatively teach either one. So I already want to say I challenge stuff in the question because I don't think that the Magisterium has weighed in on this. But I think the reason why the questioner might be under that impression is he then begins to speak of Augustine and a consensus of the fathers. And I think the questioner might be confusing a consensus of the fathers on this fact with the Magisterium. So let me make a distinction there. the magisterium is going to be the Pope and the bishops in union with him, not necessarily the church fathers. We say that the magisterium teaches authoritatively, whereas we don't say that the church fathers are necessarily the magisterium itself, but we do say that when there's a unanimity there, a consensus of the fathers on a matter of faith and morals, we say that they're reliable witnesses to the faith and tradition of the church. They're witnesses rather than authoritative, an authoritative magisterial organ. I don't want to depict this as the magisterium is the Pope, the bishops, and the church fathers, as if they're this third, magisterial organ. That's not the case. They're witnesses to the faith, but not necessarily authoritative teachers. Now, it could be that some of the church fathers were also bishops, and in their day, they also belonged to the magisterium, but that would be different than speaking of them as a church father. Okay, now we're asking the question, is there a consensus on young earth among the church fathers? And if so, are we bound to that? So let's now tackle that one. The church fathers are reliable witnesses on faith and morals only. And I'm going to locate that in Leo XIII's work, where he writes an encyclical Providentissimus Deus, and he indicates that the consensus of the fathers is authoritative on faith and morals. He doesn't say anything about on science and matters of fact. So I don't take the position that the church fathers, if they have a consensus on a matter of science or history or fact, that that's necessarily authoritative. It's only on matters of faith and morals. So even if you had every single church father teaching geocentrism or teaching young earth, that is not authoritative. And that's not necessarily even a reliable witness to tradition, because it's not on a matter of faith and morals. There was another question in there that related to what's within the scope of authority of the magisterium. Is it within its scope of authority to teach authoritatively on matters of science? No. We would say as Catholics, its area of authority is only on matters of faith and morals, or on some issue historically or factually that's necessary to maintain something in faith and morals. Let me give you an example. The church can say Jesus is fully God and fully man. Okay, but what if somebody said, well, okay, that's great, but I just don't believe that Jesus historically existed. Can the magisterium come and authoritatively say Jesus historically existed? Yes, but how can it do that? That's a matter of fact and history, not faith and morals. Yeah, but that matter of history, in fact, is necessary to maintain something that is faith and morals. So that's within the scope of the authority of the magisterium, even though technically it's not about faith and morals. It's related to it. So then the question is young earth in the same way necessarily related to something in faith and morals? I argue no. So I argue this is not even within the scope of the authority of the magisterium to settle. But somebody else might come along and say, well, they think that this is within the authority of the church, and then we can have that debate.
What a great question. Thank you very, very much for the question. We got plenty of time to do another question before we have to take our top of the hour break. We got 2 hours with Michael, though, and we got lots of great questions from patrons. We're celebrating the 12 days of Christmas here, as you are wherever you are, I imagine. And so we get to have some relaxed conversation with Michael, and we get to take these questions from patrons and enjoy the answers. And this one, it's a little bit long again. Here we go. Is it possible for there to be a papal situation where the previous pope resigned, but the next pope, for whatever reason, wasn't legitimately elected? And that anti-pope hangs on around for a long time, but short enough that the church still has sufficient valid cardinals to legitimately elect a new valid pope. Is this an entirely hypothetical question? I'm wondering if this is just a hypothetical. But all right, let me start again since I messed up. Is it possible for there to be a papal situation where the previous pope resigned, but the next pope, for whatever reason, wasn't legitimately elected, and that anti-pope hangs around for a long time, but short enough that the church still has sufficient valid cardinals to legitimately elect a new valid pope, resulting in the church actually having a sede vacante for a decade or so with almost nobody knowing, and the situation quickly being resolved with a new valid pope being elected after some time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I suspect that the question is asked because of some recent theories that have been put forward that say that Pope Francis isn't the pope and Benedict still is. And they'll try to use an argument along those lines. I think that this scenario isn't realistic. And here's why. It fails to account for what's called the universal and peaceful acceptance of a pope. It seems to completely fail to account for that, which I think entirely undermines the entire scenario. And what is that situation? What am I referring to here? Well, in the last few hundred years, we have theologians and we have a consensus here that if the church as a whole, the church dispersed throughout the world, the bishops, the laity, the faithful priests, all that, if they accept somebody as a pope at the time of their election, or shortly thereafter, if they accept them universally and peacefully, even if there was some kind of deficiency in the way the person was elected, maybe it goes against canon law or something, it would heal in the root any defects, and he would be the pope regardless. So I don't see how this could ever happen if you have a universal and peaceful reception of this individual in this scenario, which I think the scenario would require that there would be that universal and peaceful acceptance, because he refers there to, I forget what language he used, but he said something about like almost nobody knows it.
Yeah.
He's not really the pope.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that kind of assumes that they believe he's the pope. Everybody believes that he is. Well, if everybody already believes he's the pope, then you have that universal and peaceful acceptance. So it couldn't be that they universally and peacefully accepted him as the pope, but nobody knows that he really wasn't the pope, because that, again, seems to undermine that entire doctrine. So I want to say this is a scenario that could not happen.
All right. That seems simple, direct, and clear. But the tenor of the question coming at the moment, I mean, if this question had been asked 20 years ago, I wouldn't think it had any particular motivation regarding the current pope. But, I mean, this obviously has to do with Pope Francis. And it seems to me, I'm not advocating this as a position, but it seems to me that a better option for a person who really is reacting negatively to Pope Francis is to just conclude that he's a bad pope. Like that has a greater intellectual kind of I don't know, weight to it. It's more likely to be true. But we seem to resist the idea that there can be a bad pope. Like and again, I'm not saying that Pope Francis, I'm not trying to decide the matter one way or the other, but I'm saying it's perfectly okay to conclude in your mind. Jesus doesn't say, don't ever think that the current pope is a bad pope. There's no teaching like it, unless I'm wrong, Michael. So correct me if I'm wrong, because sometimes I'm a little loose in my theology.
You're not wrong. He actually makes a comparison with the teaching authority in the Old Covenant, where you have those who sit in the seat of Moses, and he says, listen to what they say, but don't do as they do, right? So he recognizes a distinction there, that their behavior could be deplorable, but they're still authoritative in their teaching. And so too it is in the New Covenant. You could have somebody who can authoritatively teach on behalf of Christ, and yet they themselves might be inconsistent with it in their behavior. So yeah, I think it's much more reasonable to say that one could evaluate a pontificate as not necessarily the best pontificate, while still recognizing that that person is the pope.
Yeah,
I don't think we have to make that logical, that next step that is actually not logical, that next leap that shouldn't be called for.
Right, right. You can come to that conclusion, and then go, well, it's in God's hands and he'll work it out in time. But you don't have to make up scenarios that are wild and frightening in some respects, that we could have a secret antipope among us or something. Michael, you'll stay for another hour?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. We will take a very quick break, and we'll be right back with more of the patron questions that come from Michael's podcast, Reason and Theology. We'll do that, and I'll give you the poem again, and we'll have more fun because it's Christmas time. Right back on this third day of Christmas on Catholic Answers Live.